Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I discuss a topic that is near and dear to both of our hearts, parenting. In today's episode, we explore the alarming trends in adolescent mental health, the unique neurophysiology of adolescent brain development, the challenges that today's teens face, how they differ from the challenges that we faced at their age, what an adolescent needs most from their parents, how to teach kids digital literacy and online safety, setting screen time limits, and much, much more. A few announcements before we get to the episode. If you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. Click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training, and you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. You hear Reed and I talk a lot about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by leaving us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And of course, if you found today's episode useful, please share it with somebody that you care about. Without further ado, here is our episode on adolescent mental health and parenting. Reed, are you a good dad?
Ooh, you'd have to ask my children that. But that's a... That's a fun question, Steve. I'm going to throw it back to you in a sec, but I will say that how much I care. Mm. Like, I can't think of anything more important to me right now than being there for my kids and showing up in the best way possible while admitting my imperfection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a very honest and wise response.
Oh, thanks.
Agreed. I think, you know, you'd have to ask my kids, maybe my wife. And I, of course, like you, I care more than I care about anything, about my kids and about being a quote unquote good dad. And maybe it goes without saying, I'll say it anyway, there's no such thing as a perfect parent, right? Yeah. I mean, I didn't have perfect parents, but I have amazing parents. And I often, when I think about how I'm showing up as a parent, I think about all the wonderful gifts and blessings that my parents gave me for having a lot of the qualities that we'll talk about today as we discuss adolescent, you know, young child mental health and the challenges of the internet and screen time, social media, those kinds of things. But it's the top of my list of priorities of how to show up in the world is how do I show up as a caring, loving, present, consistent, secure, safe parent.
Yeah, I love that. There's nothing that would spring me to action more than like doing something for my kids, being there for my kids. Yeah. And we've talked about parental guilt on here before. And, we also talked about recently guilt versus shame and all that. Even last time we recorded an episode, we were talking about those distinctions, but I think that's a kind of a symptom of how much we care. Mm. The fact that that's something that comes up and is front and center in our monkey minds sometimes when there are things to worry about. But, so that's what we're talking about today, right? Is adolescent mental health, especially these days, the world's different than when we grew up and, some things we can do, to help our kids, our teens, especially at this important time, because kids, we'll also talk about some brain science, how malleable the, child and adolescent brain is and how much it's shaped in the bosom of the family, if you will, in the early formative years.
Right.
But what was life like for you as a teenager, Steve?
I do talk to my kids about this quite a bit. They're fascinated by what life was like back in the, you know, the ancient times of the 1980s and 1990s. It's also fun for me to reflect on what life might've been like for my parents. I have, you know, one of my parents was born in one generation and my father, so my mom was, you know, born in one generation. And then my father was quite a bit older. He was 19 years older than my mom. Mm-hmm. He's since passed away. He's been passed for many years now since 2017. But, you know, so he's kind of a greatest generation guy, and my mom's of the boomer generation. And then here I am as an elder millennial, and things have changed quite a bit. So reflecting on my own upbringing, you know, there were lots of challenges, but there were lots of really cool things about growing up before teens had cell phones, before we had personal computers in the home. I spent a lot of time outside as a young kid. I have these great memories of being in my backyard, playing in the sandbox, or, you know, being in my mom's garden where there are all these wonderful smells and just feeling the sun on my back, and really enjoying playing with my friends outside, playing imaginary games, playing, you know, board games and sports, and lots of face-to-face socializing, right? And lots of and then in my adolescence, you know, I was involved in Boy Scouts. I was involved in lots of extracurricular activities at school, concert, choir, the Philharmonic Orchestra, football, student government, just lots of fun opportunities to socialize and be with other kids.
So you're saying that as a teen, your social media time per day average was not 3.5 hours like kids today?
No. I mean, we had other things. We had video games and television. I spent a lot of time just sort of squatted in front of the TV, but it was one TV, right? And so we had I have five siblings. And so we had to kind of negotiate, what are we watching and who's watching, you know, who gets to pick what we're watching. I was one of the younger siblings, so I often didn't get to pick, but
I love what you said about, well, gratitude for parents, because I love my parents like mad, and really revere them, adore them for what they did and continue to do for me and my siblings. And, and it's funny to think about, they were, and are amazing parents, and they would even have people over from the neighborhood and the local church community and teach parenting classes. And I have some funny memories of being downstairs with my siblings. Like, we'd be bugging the hell out of each other, like pushing each other's buttons while they're teaching that class up there.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny to think about, but like you said, no parent has it all figured out. But we'll talk about what matters, and is that loving relationship. I remember we used to drive. I grew up in Eastern Canada and was also outside all the time, like you, whether it's playing street hockey in the summer, or when the pond behind our house froze over, playing ice hockey on that, or just roaming. There were no cell phones, of course, and no video games for the first part of it, but we were just with each other, with other teens, with siblings, and of course some TV. But from Eastern Canada, we would take a yearly family trip in the minivan down to Florida. That was a 20-hour drive. And at first, it wasn't really possible to imagine how to get TV in your car. But eventually, we had one of those cigarette lighter adapter things and a mini TV VCR combo that we'd ratchet down to a cooler in the middle of the minivan and be able to watch some VHS tapes.
Yeah. Kids these days, you know, they don't know what it's like to be on a long road trip and have to come up with games to play. And if you had motion sickness like me, I couldn't read a book. I might've been able to steal my sister's like cassette tape of you know, Beatles songs or whatever, and listen to some music. But sometimes you just had to sit and be bored.
Oh yeah. That's another thing. I know we're going down memory lane here, but, but I would, listen to music a lot on the radio and, try to catch songs on my cassette tape to make mixtapes.
Yeah. Or using the VCR to record, you know, episodes of a series that we really liked on TV. And I remember my brother and I really loved that, 90s X-Men cartoon and, it was just so good. Or Batman, the animated series, or there's all these great cartoons, or Saturday morning cartoons. My kids were just floored at the idea of like a 20-minute episode of a cartoon we liked that we could only watch at a certain time and had to wait an entire week for the next episode. There was no binge watching when we were kids.
Until TiVo came out.
Oh yeah.
Do you, did you ever watch He-Man growing up? Yeah, that was
Masters of the Universe.
Yeah, by the power of Grayskull.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different now. So teens still are wired the same way. I mean, that's evolving, of course, because of this wild and crazy modern age we live in.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're still wired for social connection, but it's so different now. to have so many hours online and to have that as your primary way of interacting and connecting. I just think of these fundamental differences in even the reward, the feedback you'd get, say when you're worried about your outfit and going to school, and you go in and you don't really know, you might get someone saying something, but as a teen, probably not. But on social media, you post your outfit and you have this flood of comments of immediate feedback, and it does something different to the brain, right? Yeah. And just as one little example of how this is having an effect on our neurobiology and our behavior and our life.
Yeah, my son introduced me to the concept of the fit check, which I thought is an example of what you're talking about. I mean, there are these Snapchat or Instagram or TikTok videos where teenagers just sort of set up the camera and then they all sort of spin around to a song and show off their outfit. And these videos have hundreds of thousands of views and all these comments. So in a world back in the day where your social circle consisted of, you know, a few dozen teens, you could kind of manage the feedback and you kind of knew where you stood. It's hard to navigate, right? But you become part of a circle of friends and maybe you guys all start dressing similarly. And there are these small microcosmic social circles, but now you have the entire world commenting on your outfit, you know, that opens you up to make you a lot more vulnerability to the things that are so hard for all of us, but for teens in particular, this idea of acceptance or not acceptance,
yeah,
rejection, judgment, those kinds of things.
Yeah. And it'll be fun to explore at least a little bit some of the studies, the modern day studies too, of some of those things, like what does the teen brain do during a kind of simulated laboratory experiment of rejection, sensitivity versus acceptance. But one thing, an interesting way that the researchers of adolescent mental health put this difference is they call that our interactions with others and what we display on social media as permanent and public, even though you can, in theory, hide a post that you put, and teens often do, but yeah, there's no guarantee that something you impulsively put up there isn't spread throughout the world forever.
Yeah, whether it's been screenshot by somebody or downloaded or stitched in TikTok or something like that, it's hard. Once that toothpaste is out of the tube, it's hard to reel it back in.
Yeah. And so before we get too much into screen time and its impact on mental health, which is a hot topic these days, even the Surgeon General has weighed in.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be useful to kind of just take a bird's eye view of mental health in teens, because that's also a hot topic, and rightly so, like a very important one. These are our children, our loved ones, and the future of our planet. And so when you look at, like, well, depression and anxiety rates had already been rising year after year over the past decade, at least in children and adolescents especially. But then along came the pandemic, which was really interesting. So it used to be that 1 in 10 teens would have, say, depression or generalized anxiety, but now it's more like 1 in 4.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing to look at, is why did the pandemic have this kind of impact? I don't know. I have some theories, but do you have any you want to throw into the mix?
Yeah, I've got some theories. We might have some of the same theories. I think social isolation was probably a big one, right? A lot of schools shut down, and all of a sudden kids were used to seeing their friends every day, were at home. And
yeah,
depending on your home environment, that could be more or less pleasant or unpleasant, right?
Yeah.
So some teens who didn't have great relationships with parents, or they didn't have stable homes, or maybe their parents were even a source of abuse or neglect.
Yeah.
They were in that environment 24/7, which was also stressful on some of those parents too. So you're getting triggered parents with triggered teens in isolation that probably didn't help. Also, a lot of parents lost their jobs. You know, there are people whose businesses went under. Some parents died of COVID, or grandparents died of COVID. So you have loss and grief and financial stress that might've been contributing to things. And then I mentioned schools closing, you know, this happened with my kids, it disrupted their education significantly.
Yeah. That was crappy online school at first.
I feel bad for the teachers too, to try to adapt, but man, it was rough.
Yeah. And what you said about loss, I think is, has had some big impacts too, because it, in addition to the loss and grief that is huge, there was also this fear that we all had to live with. And we'll talk about why adolescents are even more susceptible to fear and kind of emotionally sensitive as well. In fact, teens are famous for their emotional sensitivity.
Indeed.
but you would essentially be living in fear that if you did go out and hang out with friends, what if you brought back this scary invisible germ thing that was so prevalent in the media of potentially causing death, especially in the older generations, like our parents and grandparents, like you said. Yeah. So you can imagine how a teen predisposed to anxiety and who's a teen and therefore extra sensitive to fear and anxiety could really take that on and struggle with it. And being so wired for social interaction with kids, with other kids, especially in some parts of the country and the world, that was just not possible. Like, I think we were a little, it was more lax here in Utah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and you saw kids lose their third spaces, right? So they have the home, they might have school, but maybe they weren't going to church. They weren't going to church activities, or they weren't playing their sports, or they weren't congregating at, I don't know, the gas station to be a loiterer and just sort of hang out. Right.
Yeah.
So again, I think the social isolation, the impact of the social isolation for teenagers cannot be overstated.
Yeah. And so all that to say that, we do need to pay a lot of attention to preparing our children, preparing this younger generation for stress, because the pandemic was one thing, but look at the world still now, since, like, look at what's going on out there, and there will be more stress to come for sure. And, but you know, I also want to not just paint a picture of doom and gloom either, because I've never seen anything so resilient as a child, like the human spirit, the ability to bounce back, but while also acknowledging that sometimes it's overwhelming and too much, and sometimes it gets to a breaking point.
Yeah. So, not to add too much more color to the picture of doom and gloom, but, what you said made me think of the challenge for parents as well, right? Because we're trying to prepare children for a future that is maybe less clear than it used to be. You know, a few examples, the advantage of college education is less clear, and it's become more and more expensive. You know, what is the world going to look like when AI really, really takes hold? And these jobs we thought were more secure jobs in the creative space, in the computer coding space, maybe aren't as secure or as available to our kids. So here we are as parents trying to nurture their interests, but also tell them, like, here's the fairly predictable path to being able to pay your bills, and it's no longer predictable. So the parents feel that, but the kids see it too. Talking to my own kids and their friends, or, you know, being on social media and seeing what Gen Z social media creators talk about, they're not feeling super optimistic.
Yeah. I want to get on a soapbox for 1 second and just say that, you know, we really need to encourage the corporations to stop trying to make a profit off of the developing teenage brain in these ways. Right. And, because it does seem to be the first time in human history where we're giving up our autonomous control, our sovereignty over, like, our social relationships and our interactions to the hands of these robots and artificial intelligences and algorithms that are dishing things out to us and having an impact for sure. So we've seen how this creates kind of scary vulnerabilities in lives, and it's just compounded in young people.
Yeah. Not to get too far ahead of our conversation, but I've mentioned Tristan Harris on the podcast a couple of times, Center for Humane Technology. I think his podcast is Your Undivided Attention, or Your Divided Attention, something like that. But he uses a phrase that these algorithms, these companies, you know, the new commodity is not oil, it's your data and it's your attention. and that the algorithms have been programmed, the phrase he uses is race to the bottom of the brainstem. Like, these companies, especially the infinite scroll social media companies, have figured out how to hijack your limbic system, how to keep the dopamine drip going. So you talk about sort of relinquishing our autonomy. That's one way that it happens when these videos or these algorithms are programmed to trigger the kinds of emotions that keep our attention, whether it's lust or it's fear or it's shame or it's, you know, desire or anger or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those things are hard to pull our attention away from.
And it's combined with this, longstanding kind of psychological principle that we've known for eons of variable reinforcement. It's like how gambling becomes addictive for so many people, of
the slot machine of attention.
Like you're pulling the lever over and over, and once in a while you get a spike of reward. Just like when you pick up your phone, go to your social media, see if you had likes or comments that give you a swipe of reward. And the variable nature of it does make it immensely more sticky in terms of habit formation. You know? But maybe we should meander through the central nervous system a little bit of the young brain, because I think there's some relevant stuff there to shine a light of awareness on, and maybe might help inform some tips to share.
Take us on a Willy Wonka boat ride of the central nervous system of the teenage brain.
Well, first of all, I think the teenage brain should have a giant, like, under construction sign on it. I mean, and not construction's not a bad thing, right? You model remodel your house, there's ideally something beautiful on the other side of that, but you have to navigate the construction process. And, like, I remember in, when I was a neuroscience undergrad and then in med school, really taking an interest in the, like, the embryonic development of the brain in particular. But what struck me is that, you know, not just the fact that even after you're born and for several years, you have like 1 million new neuronal connections forming every second, right? Like, it's a kids are rapid learning machines. But there are these six stages of CNS, or central nervous system, or brain and spinal cord development. And the first four of them happen in utero, in an embryo. But the other two don't even start until you're born. Like, I think the fifth one is like organization. So around 6 months old, you start the neurons start branching off into more distinct pathways and just forming these connections rapidly. But there's also at 6 months myelination that really kicks off or cranks up a notch. And that myelin is that sheath around the neurons that makes the electrical signals travel faster, more efficiently, and super important. And it's what can go awry in some things like MS or other CNS disorders. But so you may have this, like, this kid who's hit puberty and wears size 10 shoes now and looks like a grown up, but they're not a grown up, right? Like we said, the teens are famous for their impulsivity, for their emotional sensitivity and reactivity. Something else you mentioned about the corporations exploiting these brain science principles for sticky apps that we're realizing are having a negative impact on a lot of kids. But the brain develops in kids like from back to front. So your like occipital lobe, temporal lobe, etc., developing more, including the fear centers and all and the emotions, at long before you have a fully developed prefrontal cortex or frontal lobe, where your executive functioning lies, your logic and all that kind of stuff.
Impulse control, organization.
So that stuff is pretty relevant to teenage behavior, like decision making, planning, impulses, emotions, prioritizing information, how we manage our attention. And then you've got the amygdala, that little almond shaped thing in your, around your temporal lobe that we talk about a lot on here because it's relevant in the MDMA therapy research and healing from PTSD. But so it's your fear reaction, your gut instinct and even aggressive behavior in response to that is kind of originated there. So this think before you act concept doesn't really fully develop until, like, in your prefrontal cortex until you're 25.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm so glad you're taking us on this tour, because I'm just thinking from the perspective of a parent. And I remembered learning some of this when my kids were a lot younger, when I was feeling frustrated with things they would or wouldn't do. You know, adjust your expectations, right? If you just know this about their physiology, it might help you be a little less frustrated, maybe a little less punitive when they're not behaving like fully formed adults.
Yeah.
They're not, right? They're not just adult brains in child bodies.
Yeah, that was a big med school adage that was kind of drilled into us, is in the pediatrics training and sections, or kids are not just small adults. Yeah. Was what they'd say. You can't just downsize it, scale it down. There are other considerations for sure. And like on the amygdala front, there are studies showing that in teen depression, there's a portion of that that could be accounted for by an overactive amygdala and the fear, aggression, you know, emotional sensitivity lit up. There was this one study that I was just, that I just stumbled upon today while thinking about this topic a bit, where they looked at how adolescents perceive emotion compared to adults. And it was really interesting, like brain scanning kids 10 to 18 and compared to adults. And they would look at these expressions, one of those like fMRI scanner paradigms where you're shown some images and then they're looking at what happens, what lights up in the brain. And adults could correctly identify things like fear, but the teens had different ways of describing it. It was almost all over the place, like shocked, surprised, angry, to describe those same pictures. And then, like, even potentially more interesting is teens, more than adults, use different parts of their brains to describe what they were feeling. Mm. Like, you know, the adults had their frontal cortex on board a lot more, which governs the reasoning and planning and the logic. So, and the teens had more of that amygdala lit up. Yeah, it's just interesting. So then this emotional sensitivity becomes super relevant. Like we said, teens are famous for their emotional sensitivity. Like when you experience rejection, compared to when you feel like acceptance, is just so much more pronounced in the teen brain. Mm-hmm. And more of that like experience of rejection, and combined with how much it has an impact on the teen brain, is linked to later depression, even suicidality. And I think we could have given a million stats about teen mental health, and it's out there everywhere.
Right.
But one of the most alarming ones for me is the rate of suicidal thoughts, self-harm behavior, and worse, like suicide attempts.
Death by suicide, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, listening to you describe this, I'm reflecting on my own development as a human being and remembering how emotionally reactive and sensitive I was as a teenager. I remember it well. And even in my, I was married before my brain fully developed. I got married when I was 22.
Yeah. Cool.
And my wife likes to remind me that I am a very different man in my 40s than I was when we first got together. But I remember just feeling at the mercy of my mood when I was younger, and I was a smart kid, precocious, even really articulate, fairly introspective, but yeah, sometimes there was no amount of reassurance my poor mother could give me that would pull me out of some of these negative mood states.
Yeah, something happens, like some experience of rejection in high school, for example, and that can feel like the end of the world, like all-consuming. And it is really interesting to look at how that changes a decade later and two decades later. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't even diagnose a personality disorder before age 18, for example.
Right.
But you look at something, just to use an example, borderline personality disorder. And I know this is with all the caveats of the challenges, pitfalls, traps of putting too much emphasis on diagnoses that we've talked about. I'll just state that that there is risk in over-diagnosing for sure. But just to give the example of, you can't diagnose in a teen, and any other diagnosis is at risk of changing during that time period. But then you look at what happens through one's life with borderline personality disorder, and like 20, 30 years later, there is half or more of the population who had that diagnosis who no longer meets the criteria, just because you do learn some things over time as you age too. And hopefully.
Well, you learn some things, and it and also just sounds like, based on your description of the, of human neurological development, you age out of some things too.
Yeah.
It's not always necessarily about learning to behave differently. Sometimes just because the hardware has shifted and you're literally less emotionally reactive, then maybe the skills that you do have become more readily accessible to you.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point. So we've had some fun evolutionary tangents lately. Mm-hmm. Wondering if we could just venture into that a little bit. Why do you think that teen brains develop at this rate, and those kind of things like accentuated fear and impulsivity in adolescence?
Yeah, the evolution of conversation is interesting, because you have to ask yourself, was this thing that we have observed selected for by natural selection, or is it just sort of along for the ride? And, you know, not every quality that we have was maybe, I'm not an evolutionary biologist or psychologist.
Yeah, it could be secondary.
Yeah, yeah, it could be secondary. So it might be just a feature of having the most complex brain of any organism on the planet, that it just takes a long time to finish cooking.
Yeah.
But, you know, we are social primates, and our developmental window is a lot longer than other mammals, for example. Like, we don't drop out of the womb like a gazelle ready to run.
We need our parents to survive as human babies.
Yeah. So I guess it kind of makes sense that we would have a larger window to be sensitive, because ideally we have these sort of safer, fully developed humans to rely on.
That higher cortex that takes time. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen some theories talk about how that, well, there's the social connection that makes sense for the strength in numbers and the tribes. But, you know, as an adolescent, you're preparing to go out in the world and take risks. And by doing that, you also need your alarm bells functioning well. Mm. But this did come from the olden days. Like, evolution is slow. The world is changing rapidly. And some of this was evolved kind of assuming we're still in the jungle, right? But when we're in these cities and towns, and with like social media in our face for hours a day, and you have other things like driving cars and teenage driving behavior, or access to all these habit forming substances and behaviors, teens need to, there's a lot more attention that needs to be paid, I think, to just being on the lookout for some of those potholes that may have been kind of old evolutionary developments and now risks.
Yeah. It's something we've given a nod to a couple times in the show, this sort of mismatch between how we've evolved and how society has evolved. I think I've quoted it on the show before. I can't remember who to attribute to, but something like, we are coping with Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. And that's a difficult stew to grok.
Quite the trifecta. Yeah. There's a quote, there's this book called The Evolutionary Advantage of the Teenage Brain. Cool title.
That's cool. Yeah.
But here's a little snippet from it. One way to think about it is that the brain has two sides, an impulsive side and a cautious side, and they balance one another. Before we reach adulthood, the impulsive side of the brain is charging ahead, while the cautious side of the brain is still playing catch up. The result is a teenager. Hmm.
But maybe evolutionarily, like, when we're in the, as you call it, the bosom of the family, that's, again, ideally, a time in our lives where we have a bit more of a safety net to experiment. Yeah. So you learn by doing, you know, you learn by taking chances, being a little bit more impulsive. So you get that feedback.
Mm-hmm. There's a parenting kind of writer, author, speaker, clinician, Becky, who wrote Good Inside, who I really like. And I like how she sums up the role of a parent in two ways. Like, one, keep your kids safe. Two, let them explore.
Yeah. I was trying to think of like my most important qualities of a parent. And I came up with, you know, the kids from your, from their parents need to feel safe. They need to feel loved and they need to feel supported. And we can talk about, well, sort of what falls under each of those categories, but
yeah.
Anything else about biology or evolutionary psychology you want to touch on?
Maybe a couple more things, because in my kids, this is kind of, I find a fun one, more positive and really interesting, is why are young people, why do they seem like more activists these days? And the world needs more activists. Like, if the world's a mess, right? And but why are teens activists in general? And this malleability of the teenage brain makes it vulnerable at times, but also this enhanced social drive and pro-social kind of neuronal connections, combined with this unique kind of empathy. Like, empathy might spark kind of the wrong ideas in teens, because you might think of teens as being like self-absorbed. Selfish, yeah. In some ways, but empathy isn't so simple. Teens aren't like all selfish. You know, I look at my kids and they notice and get riled up about, in a very inspiring way, about social justice issues. Yeah. Like, and they share them and they rally around them, and they're always learning and changing, and it triggers that emotion in them, and they're more likely to act on things. Like, I think of my, my daughters and how awesome it is how, they're willing to speak up and take a stance on women's rights and things like that. It's amazing. So, and there are even these studies of like teens who went through detention centers and got a perspective of other people's experiences and hard things they've gone through, this long lasting, added empathy or ability to understand another one's struggle, which I found pretty cool, and also explains some of what we're seeing, why this young generation is standing up and saying, no, I don't agree with this.
Yeah. I see it in my kids too. And I think it's long been understood by oligarchs and dictators of the past that there's nothing more dangerous to that type of organization than a restless young person, because their idealism, you know, and I'm trying to figure out like, what's my role here as a parent when my kids are feeling the way and advocating in the way very strongly that you're describing. Mm-hmm. Cause I want to validate, certainly, as you said, it is inspiring. But I also want to provide context, cause a lot of the information they're getting now is coming through these very siloed social media channels, mm-hmm. without a lot of perspective.
Yeah.
And there's this vulnerability that the teenage mind has to be all or nothing. And to sort of not have context or nuance mm-hmm. in their perspectives. So I do this little dance with my boys of like, yes, I hear you. And I'd be mad too. And you should be mad. And I love the, activism energy. Here's some things you probably don't know about this strong opinion that you have, and trying to, like I said, it is a dance, cause I don't want to, you know, quash the, what I think is a pretty cool activist energy.
Yeah. So true. All this is making me think of a song that I quite like.
We don't need no education.
There are a lot of songs that have been stuck in my head today while thinking about, we believe children are the future, Whitney Houston. But this one that I'm thinking of is by Cat Stevens. Now, I think it goes by Yousef. Father and Son, I think it's called, or Father Son. But it's just this beautiful dialogue duet between an older man and his younger, say, late adolescent, early 20s son who wants to go off for a cause, and his dad is trying to tell him to settle down, just like, you know, settle down, get married like I did. And he's like, no, Dad, you don't understand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I can relate to that.
Yeah.
I can
relate to that. I wish we could just like play songs on here and, but I won't take the 5 minutes, but I will encourage people to go listen to it. It's a good one.
Yeah.
So disclaimers on the brain behavior research in kids is that, we have a lot to learn and this isn't easy to study. Mm-hmm. Like there are a lot of resources being put towards it. Like what's it called? The Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Consortium, like this decade long study, looking at 10,000 plus teens and a lot of things like cognition and mental health. And you need big studies to answer some of the big questions like that, but you also need the small innovative experiments to do more creative work too. Like, you know, if we only ran the big ones, we'd be missing some of that novelty. Like, what was one study I saw as an example of like showing teen brains get lit up in the reward center, more when their parents get a reward, like win something, than strangers. It's just interesting, right? That, they point to these distinctions of in-group, like, kind of the in-group dynamic of adolescent brain and reward.
Yeah.
You know, how you apply all this, you know, is kind of another conversation, but you also need what the researchers would call ecologically valid experiments, like real world. It's one thing to study something in a clinic or lab, but what about in the wild where these teens exist? And so things get simulated. There are all these cool psychology experiment paradigms, as there always have been, but yeah, you can see how it's a tricky thing to try and understand our brains with our brains,
right.
Especially these young people where it's changing so rapidly and they're getting angry at us in the meantime or whatever.
Yeah. It's like trying to read the outside of a label from with inside the jar. It's tough to do.
Yeah. So, I guess another disclaimer that we touched on is that diagnoses are tricky. Yeah. So rather than searching for a drug that's going to treat this thing called depression, it's just not so simple.
Right.
And it gets way more complicated in teens because of all these factors. So I think it points to looking more at these, what you'd call an intermediate phenotype or maybe a pathway or a network or something like anhedonia or like the lack of pleasure in things or hopelessness or certain measures of attention or executive functioning, not just ADHD as a bucket,
right?
Which means a lot of things, right? Yeah, one example I think that just to, and then I'll leave this research tangent behind so we can get into the good practical stuff. But adolescents seem to respond poorly to the same kind of exposure therapy that might be applied to adults and people try to apply to kids because of, just their brains, understandably, might respond differently to some of the fear extinction attempts. So therefore we need to make new strategies like modified exposure therapy and CBT approaches for adolescents specific to the window they're in,
right.
Just to highlight some of the complexity. So there are these developmental windows and instead of extinction for a kid, it's probably more likely to be something like memory reconsolidation or updates in that system. They just respond differently to the kind of the fear and hellfire and damnation.
It makes me think of some of the potential limitations of our profession in helping teens, adolescents. You know, a lot of kids who get prescribed psychotropics, right, psych meds, are prescribed by their general practitioner, not even a pediatrician. Certainly not a child psychiatrist. Those are few and far between. And God bless those folks. But sometimes they are just sort of scaling down the medication and giving them to kids. Or even you have a lot of therapists who aren't necessarily child and adolescent therapists who are taking on teenage clients and maybe making some mistakes, right? Kind of like the one you highlighted. And then there's this, we've talked about it a little bit, but the danger of over-pathologizing childhood.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you know, there's a real risk in these kids being even by a well-meaning therapist convinced that, you know, that their experience of their emotions is a disorder, that something's wrong with them, that they need treatment. Mm-hmm. And it might just be, sort of normative, and what they need is support. They need tools and strategies, but maybe not to develop an identity as somebody who has a particular mental illness.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. I'm glad you brought it up, because it's a question I try to remember to ask myself all the time, especially when working with young people and families, is, wait a second, is it the child that's broken, or the system we're stuffing them into, or what is that home base environment you were talking about, that foundation of safety? What is their home environment like, and how does it relate to the behaviors that are being displayed?
Yeah, and I can't cite the study, but I have read research that shows that interventions in the system are more effective for child and adolescent mental health than interventions to the being directly. Kids are so sensitive, like we're talking about, to their environment growing up. So, and you child and adolescent therapists out there know this, you marriage and family therapists out there know this, systems therapists know this, that, you know, a parent will drag their kid into therapy, and it becomes apparent quickly that the problem isn't necessarily with the kid, that they're, defiance, you know, that their impulsivity, that their emotional reactivity has at least as much to do with the relationship with their parent as it has to do with their sort of intrapsychic mental process.
Yeah. And having worked with a lot of young people through the years and having gravitated towards it for whatever reason, I've never seen something so impressive as the stubbornness of a teen thrown into treatment. You know, you need an insane amount of patience, and perspective to work with that. Yeah.
Another note on this over pathologization, you know, we've talked a lot about the stigma of mental health, fortunately diminishing, and Gen Z and younger, they're a lot more open about their mental health struggles, about how cool therapy is, how important it is to get help. But you know, some parents, well-meaning, will put their kid in therapy prophylactically. Like, we just want to make sure that they got all the good skills. And if the therapist is well-trained, that can be fine. But, again, there's this danger of over-pathologizing, and, or, you know, grandma dies and the kid's experiencing some understandable grief and they throw him into therapy, and all of a sudden grief has turned into a problem to solve. As an evidence of depression or something like that. It can turn into that, but I know a lot of our audience members are therapists and practitioners of one sort or another. I just want to foot stomp that caution.
Yeah. No, I like that a lot, and I'm glad you brought up the systems, because in thinking about what to do about all this, you know, what to do about these alarming statistics, a lot of, what comes to mind for me, lands back on, some of the things we can do as a society and a system of providing young people and their parents really good info about mental health, and promoting resilience, of course, at home. But look at how much of an effect the school system could have in what they teach, or where kids happen to be sitting there and required to listen to things, and it might be harder to do at home, and one may feel less equipped to provide some of that. So there's early diagnosis, I say with quotes, because very careful, cautious diagnosis. I'd say early intervention. Like, I see that over and over, from everything from autism to eating disorders. Like, the earlier you intervene and provide especially good social support, psychosocial support, biopsychosocial support, the better off the outcomes.
Yeah.
The role of parents and mentors, I cannot overstate. In fact, I remember a time working with a lot of kids in foster homes and Proctor family situations. And, I remember seeing something in the literature back then that just struck me of, like, the impact one good mentor could have in a teen's life would far outweigh any possible medication I could throw at someone in general. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And kids' access to such mentors is dwindling. We, you know, started the conversation talking about some of the variables that affect the decline in adolescent mental health. I think there are a lot of systemic factors. And it can vary from community to community to country to country. But just a simple example would be, at least in America, the lack of support for childcare. You know, there's some countries where childcare is funded by the government.
Yeah.
And you're seeing a lot of families that, you know, both parents, if they're lucky enough to have two parents in the household, both have to work. And there's these socioeconomic pressures and the kids are alone a lot. And, you know, we're talking more about young kids with childcare, or access to mental health care, mm-hmm. right? So there's a lot of these socioeconomic and political factors that we can't ignore. Like sometimes our profession gets criticized for being too atomistic, that it's too much about the person and only the person and taken out of context. And these contextual factors can be huge, sometimes yeah. everything.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess the good news is that the teen brain, with all its other funny quirks, is a rapid learning and growth machine.
Yeah, like very resilient.
Amazing ability to learn and adapt and respond to new experiences and situations. So feed it good stuff, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And provide those challenges, opportunities for kids. And I guess we can get into some practical considerations of like letting your kids learn and not doing it all for them.
Yeah. So let's hammer some of those out. How do we feed our kids good stuff, right? To use your words. So I mentioned the three big things, and then these are just sort of what I came up with earlier today. I think children need to feel loved. They need to feel safe and they need to feel supported, among many other things.
But yeah, I'll add one: feel celebrated.
I like that.
I love that need to throw in the mix.
Maybe you could put that under the bucket of supported, but I love celebrated.
Yeah.
So to be loved is to be what? It's to be accepted, to be loved unconditionally. It's to be validated, valued. It's to be present with, like really mindfully present with your kids. It's to show them affection, you know, and some mm-hmm. of your kids may or want more or less affection, or affection that comes through different avenues. But to really cherish and value your kids, and kids can feel that. Yeah. They can tell.
Yeah. And I really like what you said about validate, but I'm a validation junkie or a sucker for good validation, because teens need, above perhaps even all else, from their parents, you know, of course the safety and those other things, but they need to, know that they can talk to someone. Yeah. They need to feel safe. And if every time your kid brings something up, if you skip the validation to let them know that they are seen and understood, mm-hmm. and go right to solutions, even, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. So this rule of thumb that I think we've talked about a lot on here is, before you attempt any of that, validate, validate, validate.
Yeah.
Like when in doubt, do it three times.
Yeah.
Like an example, say you're working with, you say you have a teen, you're a parent of a teen or a therapist of a teen who will not talk, like mm-hmm. a common thing, like stubborn in their silence. What do you do? Like one possibility in that validation is, like, I can imagine why you wouldn't want to speak to me, because it can be really uncomfortable to talk about these feelings or whatever. Mm-hmm. I can understand why, because we haven't as a family been in the habit of talking about these things, right? You're trying to change something. Or I can imagine that underneath the silence, you might be feeling angry because this happened and that would suck, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And that underneath that, maybe you're sad. Then you can see what unfolds from there. Yeah.
Yeah. It is a foundational skill for just, I think, being a good human being who relates to other human beings, but especially important for our kids. And I've been guilty of that. I've been guilty of rushing to solutions.
Yeah, me too.
Let's fix this. Or, you know, one of my kids was struggling with his grades, and I noticed that nearly every conversation we were having was about, you know, this struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd come from school and it was like, "Hey dad, how are you doing? I'm doing great. How are your grades? Look at your grades." And I could tell, and eventually I had a conversation with him and validated this, that he wasn't looking forward to talking to me.
Yeah.
I had That's shifted.
Yeah.
It shifted from this role of being, you know, his buddy, but also a source of safety and a source of support, to this persecution. And I wasn't trying to persecute him. It was sort of my own stuff. Like I was worried and I wanted to make sure I was being a quote unquote good dad. What would a good dad do? Should I take his phone away? Like what do I do here? So I recognized that and I needed to shift. I needed to shift back to validation, and it made a big difference.
Yeah. And I'm glad you shared that example, the personal example too, which I really like when those come up, because in that case too, it's just, it's just such a common like worry as parents. Like I can relate big time of, it's really hard to walk that fine line between, being a buddy and being the police. Mm-hmm. Like I've seen, more caregiver strain, parent child relationship strain than I ever would have imagined in the like situations of say, eating disorders, just to use an example of say that if a parent has to take on the role of food police, that has an impact on the relationship. And I'm not saying there are easy ways to avoid it. Like that, I'll admit, is one of the hardest things of being a parent. If you have to try and figure out that sweet spot of setting the boundaries and the structures for safety and keeping that open, loving, trusting dialogue and relationship.
Yeah. There's this trend of gentle parenting that's going around now. And it's a approach to parenting that focuses on what we're talking about here, on, you know, on validation and creating a safe, secure relationship with your kids, not being too punitive or too arbitrary. Kind of gives a nod to the difference between authoritative and authoritarian parenting styles that we learned about. But I think in an effort to be a gentle parent and navigate that dance between, you know, being the friend or the police, sometimes we go too far to the other side.
Yeah.
And kids do need to be validated, like we're saying, but they also need structure. They need, they need predictable consequences so that they can test boundaries and then feel safe when they sort of fall back into the structural container that you've created, whether it's with your rules, your contracts, your agreements. But one of the things I've noticed my kids wanted from my wife and I and respond well to is our reasons for the structure. I love it. And it's also a challenge, but my kids are fairly precocious in that way. They will not tolerate arbitrary dictatorship in the household. So yeah, we've had to give them reasons like, okay, well, this is why we have this rule. And they're generally pretty responsive to that. Like, okay, we see that. Can we make an adjustment here?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think an excellent point. And it, through the ages, it's interesting to see the focus on helicopter parenting as, and its negative impacts, but the same applies to the opposite too, of too hands off. And, and it is a parent role, like we said, earlier on, is to keep them safe and set the boundaries, and to maintain consistency in that is huge for the kid's sense of safety, even if they're fighting it.
It makes me think of something that I got a lot of as a kid from my wonderful parents, and that was trust. You know, my mom used to say, "I'll teach you correct principles and let you govern yourself." I think that might have been a Joseph Smith quote, actually.
Yep.
But yeah, I loved that from them. I felt trusted by them and I didn't want to break that trust. So I didn't have, you know, I was a pretty, agreeable kid. I didn't have lots of desires to do evil. I certainly had friends who did though. And, I didn't want to break that trust. I didn't want to lose that trust. And, so we've tried to cultivate that in our family. Like we trust you.
Yeah.
Baseline. We're starting from a place of trust until you give us a reason not to. Here are some things that if you did would cause us to, you know, feel less trusting of you. Mm-hmm. So just offering that at the outset, I think went really far for me as a kid and has gone far for my kids.
Yeah. Same here. It's something I think about all the time in interactions, especially with my teenagers, is just, reminding myself not to jump to conclusions, to keep that trust front and center, even if they may have messed up, which every kid does. Like just that stance of, it's okay. I still want to provide this safe container for you to share it. And we're going to work on this together. And I love you, no matter what. And, but providing that space where they can open and have you on their team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I will admit, one of the more challenging things, as a parent to do with love is to hold a boundary when the kids don't get it. When they still feel like you're being unfair.
Yeah.
You know, especially when it's a consequence, and hopefully, you know, your kids know what the consequences are. The consequences for self-destructive or negative behavior are not arbitrary. They're tied to the behavior itself, right? It's not like, oh, you can't have candy anymore because you told me to shut up or whatever. Like,
yeah. Sometimes, and this is another Dr. Becky thing that I really like that she focuses on a lot in her Good Inside book and her content is consequences should be in the real world, ideally.
Yeah.
And maybe those real world consequences are enough. Like if someone, you know, gets in trouble at school and they have detention and like, yeah, do you really need to take away their totally unrelated thing for an insane amount of time?
Right.
And I can't, you know, I can't give a one size fits all recommendation for any parent child situation and acknowledge that some of those parent child situations are so hard and I would have no idea how to navigate either. But that's something I try to remember as well is, let's look at the real world consequences and see what's already there and what makes sense, if anything, to add.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we're talking about, I think, falls under my general category of safety. But what about supported and celebrated? You know, I remember my parents showing up at all our concerts, all our plays, all of our football games. Even though in retrospect, football made my dad very anxious. He didn't even like to watch professional games. He'd kind of come in, what's the score? Okay, that's too much.
he
would leave. But man, he was there. He was there for all of our games. I remember I got seriously injured in a football game. And as I sort of was crawling off of the field, my old dad was jumping the stands, coming down to see how I was.
Yeah.
And that just meant everything to me. And I could set my watch by my parents. They're just so reliable. So I've tried to do that for my kids because I recognize how important it was to, and creating that sense that they were there for me and they supported me.
Yeah. Yeah. So we mentioned this in a past conversation, but attention is the currency of love, especially for children. And consistency is key in there and how you show up, how you respond, and time means everything.
Yeah. If you miss one concert, it's not the end of the world, folks. Like again,
we're
talking about the importance of attention and consistency, but you know, no such thing as a perfect parent.
And like quality over quantity too.
Yeah. And so how do you dial up the quality? You do it with what you're saying, with attention. You know, if your kid wants to play video games with you and you're on your phone, you know, checking your email or multitasking, they'll see it, you know, they'll feel it.
Yeah, they feel it. And just naturally, it's kind of like something wired into us naturally will move on from that. If you're not in it, just like if a friend wasn't, or if someone's not paying attention, they're sharing something exciting. Eventually the sharing dwindles.
Yeah. And then one thing about celebration that I've been thinking a lot about lately is, you know, we talked about how the future for our kids is a little ambiguous. We're not sure what the world's going to be like and how to prepare them for it. But I've tried to celebrate my kids' each unique interests, even if in my worried mind, it's not clear to me how their interests are going to lead to a profitable career.
yeah.
You know, their ability to make a living. I have, you know, been trying to do my own work about that. And celebrate their interests and try to nurture their interests.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important for, especially for adolescents to feel that from their parents.
When there's a spark of curiosity, like I've just learned through the years that's what to follow or what to foster, fan the flame, because it doesn't work to kind of prescribe, impose something on them. I mean, like, and there are some, you know, subtleties to this, like when my two oldest kids were maybe around middle school age or preteen, I remember taking them both into a music store and saying, like, pick an instrument to learn. But there was that encouragement, and part of it's probably projected or fueled by me regretting dropping out of piano lessons as a teen and things like that. But and then it sticks or it doesn't. But I know in my twins right now, where they take an interest in something, I get excited for them and that interest because it's fueled by something inside them, and that, you know, has a chance of going somewhere. It's something that comes from in them, not projected from us. Yeah.
So I'm getting this sense of like curiosity and excitement coming from you as you talk about your kids. And I think that's really, really important, because in our fear or in our, I don't know, megalomania, we might try to shape our kids into mini versions of us, or you need to be a doctor, you need to be a lawyer, you know, you need to be a whatever. But how much more exciting is it to help them be who they are?
Yeah.
Right. They're going to transcend you. Maybe they're just going to be unique, and they're going to have little traces of you because they are your kids. But, to me, that's a much more exciting creative project as a parent than to just sort of try to force them into a mold in which they will not fit.
Yeah. I get super excited about, you know, we talk about ancestral burdens and inherited suffering, and that's, a big thing, and can be really hard and challenging. But there's also these ancestral gifts and things that you can give. But aside from all that, I just like the idea that, like, I would love it if my kids transcend me in their own ways and in whatever ways they want. Of course, as a parent, you want them to flourish, and ideally into their unique, the full flowering expression of their unique individual self the best way that can. And like, you've met my oldest son, you've met many of my kids, but I look at, how my oldest son, like, moves through the world with more presence and mindfulness than I could have dreamed of at that age. And more than I do in many ways, many situations. And I admire that and learn from it and get inspired by it. It's pretty cool to see when they, like, sometimes we don't want them to, or we shouldn't want them to just be cookie cutters of us, because it's taken generations to figure some things out.
Yeah, absolutely. So be present. You know, you might add some structure to being present, regular touch points with the kids, you know, if your schedule permits, or even if it doesn't, you can force it to permit having regular meals together. I have something that we call family meeting. I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, where every night before the youngest goes to bed, we all gather and we might share a piece of wisdom, or we might just sort of talk about our day. And
that's cool.
Sometimes those have turned into really important conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. Providing the opportunities for stuff to come up naturally.
Yeah.
Right. There's one, fun game, just to give like a random personal example, that I was playing with my kids, a week or two ago when we were sitting around the dinner table. It's called We're Not Really Strangers. And my youngest daughter had tipped me off to it a couple years ago. And it's a really cool organization that makes this card deck and a lot of swag that's uplifting and has positive messaging. Like, she was following them on Instagram as an example of something uplifting on social media out there.
Yeah.
But this game, you pull a card with a deep question that the person pulling the card has to answer or get answers from others in the game. And it was just really neat. But one of the things that came up was around, you know, it just led to this conversation of parent, nervous system regulation. And, it gave me a chance to reflect on a couple things. Well, one, I do believe that, you know, all the work you can possibly do on, like, being aware of and regulating your own emotions is going to be the most useful in parent-child interactions. Like, that we say calm is a superpower. Like, to be able to remain calm when they're in distress goes a long way for a sense of safety, or to remain calm when they're when they're in trouble or sharing something that's just triggering. With the disclaimer, like, that I can almost anticipate you throwing to the mix, because it's important, and you remind me of this lots of that, it's okay to lose your cool sometimes. No one is perfect. And that also gives you a beautiful chance to apologize and show your humanness, right? Yeah. But I think my self-regulation and unflappability, if you will, has come in, most handy in just parenting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you want to help your kids, help yourself. I remember I wrecked the family van 9 days after I got my license as a teenager. And this is before cell phones. I rolled it down a pretty steep hill, actually rolled it several times, midnight, climbed up the hill, went to the nearest house, pounded on the door, got them to call my parents. And I remember the energy with which my parents showed up at the top of that hill. And it was so, they were worried, of course, but so calm. Not punitive, like, what's wrong with you? Why'd you wreck our van?
Are you okay, Steve?
It was, are you okay? We're so glad you're okay.
Yeah.
And ironically, I had the opportunity to do the same for my son when with his learner's permit. And I'm in the shotgun and he's driving and he pulls into the garage too fast and crashes the car. And he's losing it, of course, scared, apologetic. And, you know, maybe this is one of those generational gifts I got from my dad, but I was super calm.
Yeah.
It's all right, dude. Just a car. You're safe. We got insurance. It's okay. And he tells me that was really important for him.
Yeah, that's neat. No, a great example. And something I think we all, you know, anyone who's a parent or spends time with the young people, it's a good reminder of just, that state of presence, aspiring towards that kind of loving awareness, if you will.
Yeah.
And, remembering what matters and staying calm and helping them feel, you know, continue to trust and feel safe.
So do what you need to do on your own so that you can show up that way for your kids.
Yeah.
Before we end, we should probably talk a bit about the screen time issue. This is something I've thought about a lot. And as the kids have aged and developed, my wife and I have come up with different strategies. You can Google it. There are plenty of great strategies out there. But one of the things that's been important to me, especially as my kids enter adolescence, is digital literacy.
Yeah.
So helping them understand the race to the bottom of the brainstem that we talked about earlier. Hey, if you notice that you're feeling sluggish after hours of watching YouTube shorts, there's a reason for that. And you might want to just, you know, go outside and look at the mountains or go on a walk, play, do something different.
And that comes best through not only giving pro tips to your children, but modeling the behavior, right? Like, and we can all benefit from that. I think I read someone's advice, some famous author, maybe it was Simon Sinek or someone who was just talking about a personal kind of ritual or habit he had of putting his phone aside for an hour plus every evening and going on a walk or doing something outside with kids or with a loved one and just to be able to be present.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, like, what are the chances that you're going to get and look at a notification or get a phone call that's going to take you from that? And what, you know, and how important is that time, that currency of love or attention in the moments you have?
Right? You know, Reed and I, you and I are old enough to have seen this change in families. Like, I remember when I was younger and the family was together, if we weren't all watching the same show on TV, we had to interact with each other. And then I remember, you know, slowly over time, as my family got together for Christmas, a couple people would be on their laptop, or, you know, once we were getting cell phones, a couple people would be on their cell phones. But now I'm sure many of you can relate to this. It's a regular occurrence that we have 10 people in a room and everyone's looking at their phones. So we're present, but we're not present.
Yeah.
And I see that in my family, you know, and there are moments when maybe we all just need to chill and relax. We don't really want to interact, but we're in the same room and everyone's on their own device.
Yeah.
But I think your point is well taken that, it can be really important to just sort of turn it all off. And
it's a zombie apocalypse out there. Let's be honest, like, texting neck running rampant.
Yeah.
Like when we go out these doors, you know, or if you go to the mall, let's say, you're going to see a bunch of people, young and old, hunched over as they walk or as they sit in a gathering of humans, just looking at their screen and swiping. And I think it's really worth just owning up to that as a society, that that's a challenge that we face. And there are some things, some important things we can do, like, as an example, having modeling the behavior and setting the container for not doing that at the dinner table.
Right.
Right.
and you can structure that as with a rule as a parent. Like, we don't have phones at the dinner table. That includes us, right? Mom and dad are putting their phones away. Or we have regular screen breaks on weekends.
Yeah.
When our kids were younger, we would have that. We had, you know, these are media-free days or media-free hours. And they would try to wiggle it in. Like, what if I'm working on like a project? You know, what if I'm doing my game design thing? Can I use the computer? Like, okay. But so, you know, it's important to be flexible. But, and then, you know, there's a difference between an iPad that the kid's watching YouTube on and a cell phone where they might have social media accounts or Snapchat or they're constantly connecting outside of the house. So certainly you'll hear this from many people who give advice about this kind of thing. No phones in the bedroom at night when they're going to bed. Buy them a little alarm clock. You know, they don't need their phone in there.
Because it will, for a teenage brain or younger, you know, it will provide a temptation too great, just like neurobiologically. And of course, we can't emphasize enough the value of sleep in all humans, but especially in the young generation. I mean, like, babies who are sleep deprived are wailing, crying, cranky toddlers. That doesn't really go away. We just learn some self-regulation skills, but you can see teens and grown-ass adults behaving in the same way from sleep deprivation alone.
Tired Dr. Steve is not the same as well-rested Dr. Steve, that's for sure.
And how would a teen, how are they supposed to know how to do all this, right, on their own or have all the tools? So, and something else you said I thought was useful of, like, you set the rules, you set the algorithm yourself, not... It doesn't come from the robots. Like, you can, you could tell your internet router to cut the Wi-Fi at midnight if you want to,
right?
If you're tired of having that battle every night or whatever. And there is something safe and valuable about having consistency or a system like that, whatever it looks like.
Yeah. And if you're trying to implement this, you know, it would be natural for the kids to push back initially. But if you stay consistent and you give a good rationale for why you're doing it, they'll eventually just look at it as phases of the moon. This is just part of nature. The Wi-Fi turns off at midnight. Nothing to be done about it.
Yeah. Just like the sun sets. Yeah,
tide goes in, tide goes out.
It'll come up again. We hope.
Yeah, we hope.
With faith. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Any other pro tips here?
Well, there are many. One thing I wanted to mention on social media is one of the stats that you probably read all the time, that 60% of teenage girls have been contacted by a stranger on social media in a way that's inappropriate or makes them uncomfortable. I was recently sitting, I was at one of my siblings' homes, and their teenage daughter was actually reading some of these comments that she got in her inbox on social media. And I was shook. Like, I was blown away by the number of requests from creepy old dudes who were entering her inbox to send these propositions or totally kind of sleazy messages. It was disturbing. So I think that's something to open the dialogue about as well, and have that family media plan and open, safe, inviting dialogue around it.
Yeah, how to stay safe on the internet. I was talking to a police officer in my neighborhood, and he was talking about how there's this uptick in people posing as teens, contacting teens on Instagram or one of these other places and trying to solicit nude photos. And then they'll use them as blackmail. And they're like, I'm going to send this to everybody on your contact list unless you give me $500. And it's, of course, really, really distressing and terrible. Yeah. So telling, you know, educating, like you're saying, educating your teens about what's out there and how to stay safe is really important.
Yeah. And this is like mostly unrelated, but I'm just thinking of even the grown-up generation and older generations are even more at risk for some of the scams that are showing up online. It's crazy. Like, I don't think we can count the number of times that you and many of our colleagues have gotten an email or a text from someone pretending to be me asking for a gift card.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, you'll see this like bogus, messy email and some other inconsistencies. But it's a scary world out there, especially online.
A lot of people who've been scammed that way.
Yeah.
And just buckle up for when AI can mimic your voice. I mean, that's already happening. You know, you get a call from a voice that sounds exactly like your kids and they're saying I've been abducted or whatever. It is a scary world, but not to fearmonger too much.
Yeah.
Lots of things that you can do to help protect your kids online.
Yeah. But otherwise, more general tips, just to reiterate that I think we've touched on, would be like teaching your kids to problem solve instead of solving the problems for them. Teaching them to fish, like you said. And along those same lines, it doesn't really help as much to say in those situations why, like the why. It doesn't necessarily promote problem solving as much as how does. Like, not why did you leave your bike in the rain, but, you know, how are we going to fix the rusted chain as an example?
Yeah, like
and not providing all the answers. Then one other thing is like trying not to be too catastrophic. Like, you know, if you swim right after you eat, you're going to drown and die.
Cramp and die.
You don't want to lose your credibility, but it's important to learn to swim and keep ourselves safe.
Yeah. Even a little thing like be careful. You know, I've certainly said that a lot, especially when my kids were younger. But just sort of, you know, human beings are self-preserving animals, right? That certainly you want to educate them about potential dangers, but yeah, let them stumble. Don't be a helicopter parent, like you said, or a snowplow parent, or whatever they're calling those types of parents these days.
Yeah, don't accommodate every need. And remember that some of these overprotecting tendencies, which I understand, like we want to overprotect our kids. If we could, we would protect them from everything possible. But it also, overprotection can fuel their anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And because when we try to provide certainty over every possible discomfort every time, you know, it does rob them of the opportunity to learn those skills that they will need in life. Yeah.
Yeah. We've talked about that in therapy too, like not to quote unquote rescue or spare your clients from difficult emotional experiences, that you can learn a lot and grow from moving through those experiences. As painful as it might be, as many quote unquote mistakes you might make, that's really how humans learn best.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe just a final thought from my end would be, it's never too late to work on this stuff. It's never too late favorite. It's a line from one of my favorite books. The last line in the book of this, Tom Robbins book called Still Life for Woodpecker, is it's never too late to have a happy childhood. Mm. But as parents, you never give up, and any kind of added presence or love or support or seeing them go so far, and we do need to make these tools. There are benefits of social media, like, and 95% of plus kids are on social media, so we need to make those tools work for us. We need to just have those real conversations with each other and with our kids and our loved ones of how to support one another, you know?
Yeah. Well, Reed, for what it's worth, you sound like a pretty good dad.
Likewise, Steve, I've learned a lot from you and your parenting. I really appreciate it and admire it. So thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. Right back at you. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel. like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.